the time this plays, we should all be welcoming in fall. However, when we're doing it, it is hot outside. It's August, but with the time this plays, which should be sometime in late September, early October, fall should be here, and I am ready. Hello there, I'm Phil Parr. And most of you already know that. We have gotten those guys out of here with those hammers and saws and all that blind handyman stuff. We're ready to settle back and do our little so-called blind like me. It's good to have you with us. Feeling good today. Hope you are feeling good. And as Tater Pete Hunter would say, hope everything's off to a good start out at your house. Actually, Pete Hunter didn't say that. Actually, Horace McQueen said that. I'm sure lots of people have said that. Anyway, this is Blind Like Me, and we have a fellow today that's, I think, a very interesting guy that seems that a lot of blind folks knew about this gentleman. I didn't, and I don't know how I missed him. And you'll see toward the end of the interview why it would be important that I would know about him. He publishes a magazine called Playback, which is right up my alley, or the kind of thing I would enjoy. Anyway, here's Ed Potter. We'll introduce him, all right? With Ed Potter, and you're in North or South Carolina?
Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Goldsboro,
right.
North Carolina. That is a town of what size?
Oh, I'd say around 30,000 people. It's a tobacco town and barbecue town.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Good heartburn. Zantac sells a lot here.
Tums and Rolaids, I guess, also. And how long have you lived there?
I lived here since 1973 when I got out of graduate school.
Well, let's start long before that. You were what age, sir?
71. Am I that old? I must be only about 45, actually, Phil. No, 71.
Are you really 71?
Yes, I am 71 years old.
I guess I didn't ask you that last time.
No, don't you think I sound young?
You
vivacious,
sir,
vigorous, outrageous.
You don't sound vivacious at all, but young you do. You sound a lot younger than a 71-year-old man, I'll tell you that.
Well, I am grateful that you say so. People have not commented on my demeanor, but I assume it's the same.
I see you have that good sense of humor. You've maintained that.
You have to have.
You have to have to get through this life, don't
right.
you?
Right.
Yeah. And so you were born where?
I was born in a little country town called Kelly in Bladen County. It's about 25 miles from Wilmington, North Carolina.
So you're not far from your birthplace.
No.
The peach doesn't fall far from the tree,
that's
did it?
It.
And you were born with an eye problem, or what happened?
Yes, I was. Well, I assumed I was born blind. They discovered when I was about 2 or 3 months old that I didn't seem to be responding visually to things, and so we were a country family, and so they took me apparently to the doctor, and he said, "Hey, this guy can't see."
Yeah, he really can't. He just because he when you wave your hand in front of his face,
right.
He does nothing.
Yeah, nothing there.
And it took them a while to discover that.
Yeah, it did.
That happened a lot back then.
Right,
now,
it did indeed.
Now, of course, they know immediately
a
child
yeah.
is blind. And so this was about 1931, 32.
Yeah, even before Franklin Roosevelt made his first inauguration speech.
Well, before the WW2.
That's right.
So, and you grew up in this little country town. Did they attempt to school you or what?
Actually, I didn't grow up there. Work times were tough, and we moved to Wilmington when I was about 4. My dad was a crane operator. Actually, he did repair on the county school buses in Bladen County, where Kelly was located. But times were tough, and so he thought he could do better in Wilmington. So we moved there in 1936 or thereabout, and that's where I grew up, actually.
So you were about 4 when
yeah.
that move was made. You don't remember it, I guess, but you...
Yes, I do. I remember crying wonderfully well for having to leave my swing in Kelly.
And you remember being 4 years old and doing that?
I do.
See, we have this argument all the time. My father-in-law doesn't remember anything past under 30.
Well, sometimes I'd rather not either, but
I remember being very small.
Yeah, so do I.
And I don't know if that's a blind thing or not. We'll explore that in another.
I can remember walking up a dirt road in the country with my mom to visit a lady named Miss Bertha, who always put a black walnut in my little shirt pocket. And Mom told me that I was only about 2 and a half when that happened. And I remember it very, very well.
Well, we moved from St. Louis when I was two. I'm 62. We moved from St. Louis in 42, and
you're
I remember
just a child, don't you?
Well, I remember. Yeah, I'm just a child. I remember the train ride. People don't believe it.
Yeah.
So you actually were. This was still a rural sort of a setting, though, wasn't it?
Well, Wilmington was not really what you'd call rural. It was a much smaller town than it is today. I suppose Wilmington at the time must have had something like 25 or 35,000 people.
Yeah.
And of course, it was close to the beach, so it had a kind of a recreational aura to it.
And that was a big town then, 35,000
people. Yeah, yeah.
And what did they decide to do about your schooling?
They decided I would go to the what they call the blind school.
Yeah.
They called it the Governor Moorhead School up in Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was I was a small child. I had every possible communicable disease before I was five. And the doctor tells me today, Phil, that this is why I don't seem to have anything wrong with me ever. I had diphtheria, double pneumonia, colitis, you name it. I had it before I was five, and after five, I never have been in the hospital since.
And so you got all that out of the way.
Got it all out of the way.
In an early age.
Yeah.
But then that's dangerous because they didn't really have the medicines now.
They did
then,
not. They did not. And so when I was six, they took me up to the school in Raleigh, and I was too small to reach the water fountain.
Oh.
And the matron, they called them matrons in those days, at the school was actually a person who should have been in a psychosis ward because she said, well, we can't keep him if he can't reach the fountain. And so Mom was glad to take me home again for another year. And so I went back at seven, and that's where I stayed until I graduated.
You went back at seven, so that gave you kind of a poor start in that you were doing 7 years old and the other kids were six in the first grade there,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah, right.
Well, that slowed you down a year, but what the heck, you
it
know?
It didn't matter.
I think I failed the second grade, so I virtually, I couldn't, and they began teaching you Braille.
Oh, yeah, Braille, I could not say too much about Braille. You know, all this stuff they talk about with respect to technology is great. But if you can't read Braille, there's so many things you can't do. I do Playback Magazine. You probably know I do a catalog. And I could not do it unless I could read really well Braille cards.
Mm-hmm.
So all this, I've seen all these articles about these super blind guys talking about, well, Braille's on the way out. Technology's going to take over. That's a bunch of BS.
Because
Braille is so totally personal, we'll never be able to do without it who want to be as flexible as we can.
So you've read many books in Braille.
Oh, yeah.
Many, and if you read a book, that would be as good.
That would be my medium of preference.
And you take, talking books from APH in Braille all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And you get magazines in Braille. And,
I get all the magazines I can use in Braille, and that's always my preference. I just don't like to be read to. Never have.
You
but
don't?
I don't mind being read to if I have to be. But my medium of preference is Braille. And I think one of the things that makes it my preference is because, and I don't mean this in an egotistical fashion, but I read Braille fast and well. I can understand those who have to have a kind of a labored Braille performance who would much rather not do it, but Braille is the only way to get a voice from between you and the material, and that's the way I like it.
Well, you hit on the key, and the key is those of you who can read Braille accurately and enjoy it.
Right.
I can't read it, don't enjoy it, never read a book in it, can't stand it, hate it, have no Braille whatsoever.
Everybody to his own.
Oh, yeah, everybody to his own.
But, you know, when it comes to policy, that's a different animal, isn't it?
I was touch disabled or something. I can't, when I get back to the first of a line, I don't know where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. I can play guitar and I can play piano and I do all kinds of things in my hand. I couldn't read, I can't read Braille. I can't. Do it. It's something I can't do.
Well, Phil, you can fix toilets, and I can't do that. So
well,
I
can do that. I've done a good bit of that. Done a lot more than that than reading Braille. So they began teaching you Braille, and your experience there was less than fun, or you didn't like it, or what?
Well, I don't think it was just that I didn't like it. Back in those days, and you can talk to anybody who's listening to this show who went to school in those days, there was a lot of, I would say, on-the-line criminal behavior, the way that the schools for the blind were run.
Yes, I know.
I can remember as a little child when we would come back with our Christmas toys, the first thing that the, quote, matron would do is if they had any noise to them, she'd take them away and give them to us when we went home in the spring.
Yeah.
And she made us sit Saturday afternoon quietly and listen to the Metropolitan Opera, and I've hated the Metropolitan Opera ever since.
I went to school starting in 45, yeah. and I had the same experience.
Oh, yeah.
They were mean to me. They were punished me because I was being blind. I hated every minute of it.
I hated it, too.
Took me a long time to get past it. And
there were mentors at the school. There were people who were different, and I have to give them credit. There were people that got to know me, and I got to know them, and they were the means for my getting through without being socially scarred.
There were a few of those. Yes, there were. I ran on to a couple of music teachers.
Right.
Who were a lady who was married to a blind man. They were wonderful people, but they were few and far between. Most of the people, and I know everybody gets tired of me talking about this. I mention it on almost every show. They weren't interested in blind people and how we were going to do when we got out of school.
No,
they didn't give a damn.
As a matter of fact, they didn't want you to do any kind of mobility training when I came in at all.
No, they wanted you to weave baskets or...
They wanted you to run into trees.
They didn't care. It didn't make any difference.
Right.
They just wanted to get rid of you, get through with you. And the reason they made you listen to Opry is so they could have some free time. They didn't have to fool
you.
They could take a nap then.
That's exactly it.
And so they gave us a little rest hour on Saturday and Sunday afternoon.
We
stayed in. It was supposed to be an hour. Usually it was a couple hours. I never went to sleep any rest hour they got.
Nor did I.
I couldn't. I was wired, man. I wanted to London. I wanted to run.
So was I.
All right. So you did 12 years at this Moorhead. Yeah. You call it the Moorhead School now.
Right.
And did you do well as a student?
Yeah, I guess I ought to just tell you, we had a graduating class of four, and I was valedictorian.
Well, that's that you say four, but you know, if it'd been 40, you probably still would have been. So
I don't know, but I was, and you know, that's fine.
Your grades were up. You read Braille well. So you excelled there. See, I had both against me. I couldn't read Braille, and they didn't like me.
No.
Besides that, so you graduated valedictorian in your class, yep. And you at that point in time, you were 17, 18 years old.
Well, I was actually 20.
Is that right?
Yeah, because you see, back in those days, Phil, they started you out in the kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
and then you went to the first grade. So I was in the kindergarten at 7, and that's where they taught you Braille, actually. They didn't wait till the first grade to teach you Braille.
Yep.
They did it in the kindergarten.
What did you think you might want to do when you were a young 20-year-old?
Well, all I wanted to do was to be a radio announcer.
You fell in love with radio at an early age.
At an early age.
So you grew up listening to Fibber McGee and Molly Ranger and all those wonderful things. I guess do you have a pretty good collection of that stuff?
Oh, yeah. I have what must be 12 or 15,000 hours of the stuff on open reel tape.
No kidding.
Yeah.
On open reel?
Open reel. I still have six big open reel TAC decks sitting over here.
Do you now?
Yeah.
Well, I've got one still hooked up.
Love them.
I've got three or four, but I've only got one hooked up because I don't much use them anymore.
Well,
anyway, you fell in love with radio at an early age, and you'd sit around and imitate the announcers. And
oh, yeah. And when I was a little kid, we had a wind-up turntable record player. And as a child, I used to play like I was a – they didn't call them disc jockeys when I was coming up. I don't know what they called them. Anyway, I'd play records and pretend I was talking between the records and all that sort of stuff.
I don't know what they called them either, but everything was block programmed.
Oh, yeah.
The radio stations, what were your, I guess you could, you listened at night, DX'd around and
listened. Oh, yeah, and you could get all the stations at night. You can't do that anymore, though.
No, the AM band is quite crowded now. You're lucky to do any good at all now. It's just mostly stations from south of the border where I am.
I expect it is.
Yeah, and but you in Carolina there, I guess you could hear all the New York signals, Boston and the big stations.
Mm-hmm.
And you wanted to be a radio announcer.
Right.
So toward that end, what did you do?
Well, I went to the Commission for the Blind and said, I want to go to Radio Television Motion Picture School in Chapel Hill.
Well, I bet they love that.
They did. And they put me through every kind of test you can imagine. They took me down to a local radio station and had me interview somebody on the air. And they read a classical album cover, and I had to ad-lib an introduction to it. Well, I'd already had some experience in broadcasting because I was a piano player, and I had a regular afternoon show from the age of 17 to about 20 in Wilmington. So, I wasn't totally unfamiliar with it.
So you would play, tell us about that. You'd play the old pop tunes?
You know, block programming, and I had a thing called Piano Ramblings that came on at 4:45 on WMFD in Wilmington.
Uh-huh.
And we had a big fight about that, though.
Why is that?
But this is probably a long story, but I'll make it short.
It's all right. Go ahead. We've got all the time in the world.
They introduced me on the show as the young blind piano player. And I said, I'm blind. I'm not ashamed of it, but blind has nothing to do with my being a piano player. And if you want me to play piano, fine, but you aren't going to introduce me as a young, blind piano player. Well, it got to the manager of the station. He scratched his head, and he said, well, would you mind if on your last show we said this will be the last program because he's heading back off to the school for the blind in Raleigh? I said, well, that sounds like a fair compromise.
Okay.
So that's what they did.
And you made him stop saying...
I made him never young, to say it.
The blind piano player.
Right.
I did a television show in Houston for about 10 years, and this old man, dumb old man, his name is Utah Carl. He had very little talent. I don't know how he got the show, but anyway, he'd always introduce me. Here's our blind boy, Philip.
I know.
And I needed the money bad enough I didn't say anything.
Well, I wasn't getting anything anyway for it.
I was
a proud and kind of cocky kid. I haven't changed that much, but anyway, I was.
I had to pay my bar bill at the end of the week, and I needed the money.
I understand that.
I was raising a couple of kids, and so I put up with it, but it was just stupid for him to say that.
Oh, sure.
What did that have to do with anything?
Well, it didn't have anything to do with being a piano player. If they were saying, I want to introduce you to a blind jet pilot, then that would be an interesting thing to combine.
Yeah.
But otherwise, no. Anyway, what happened to me is after they did all these tests, they took me over to the radio school and introduced me to the chairman of the department, Earl Wynn, who accepted me. And he said to me, Mr. Potter, I don't know how we're going to teach you, but if you can figure out what we have to do as we tell you, we'll let you in. And so they let me in. I was the first guinea pig to do it.
First blind person ever.
Now, here's an interesting story. I think they liked me, and I'm really grateful for that. And I got far more praise and publicity than I ever deserved. But the next guy who came in was the next year, and he had graduated, and he wanted to get all the publicity Potter was getting. And you know what? They didn't put him through a single test. Radio school, because I was doing well, let him in, and he flopped. I mean, totally bombed out. And what happened then, Wes Wallace, who was the chairman of the department at the time, he bombed, closed the radio school to blind people. Now, what I'm saying here, Phil, is we might like to say we're all independent, but every one of us is going to set a kind of a tone for all of us. And
yeah.
This was exactly what happened. So I went to Wes and I said, you can't do this. Just because he didn't work out and you think I did, the next guy will probably be a lot better than me. He said, well, we can't do it. I said, well, it's not fair. He said, all right, we'll do it if you say they can come. I said, I will not play God, and I wouldn't. So I would not take on that role. And I don't know if any others ever really applied for radio school up there, but that was the experience. And I don't think it's uncommon, Phil.
Let me take just a short break here and run a couple little things, and we'll be back with Ed Potter in just a minute and more of our show called Blind Like Me.
Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now with this week's Blind Site, here's Don Shaw.
Did you ever wonder if some long lost relative left you some money? Or did you ever move from one city to another and say, man, I should have gotten that deposit back. Where is it? For that matter, I wonder if anyone has ever left me any money. Well, if you think that could have happened to any of these, all of the above, whatever, if you just think that someone might have left you some money at some point, you need to go and check out missingmoney.com. In fact, this very thing happened to me a couple of years ago. I went to missingmoney.com and registered and put in my name, which is what they want you to do, and it will do a search over the United States and see if any money has been left from anyone, any organization has been left to you. And sure enough, it found my name and found some money that I had come into that I didn't even know about. It was from a company that I had previously worked for before that. I had left. We had moved to a different city, and they owed me for a week's vacation that I didn't know about, didn't know where I was. So the money went to the state controller's office, and it was listed on the Missing Money website. So I was lucky enough to collect it. It was great. Just one of these unknown things that happened from time to time. any way it might be worth looking at, go and check out www.missingmoney.com. That's www.missingmoney.com. All one word, no spaces, as usual. And see what you may find out. You might like it. I'm Don Shaw. Until next time, keep on web sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
Our guest today is Ed Potter, and we've gotten him through high school and into radio school. Now, what sort of things did they teach you at this school of radio?
Well, of course, you took voice and diction. That's when you had to sound like a radio announcer.
Yes.
You don't anymore.
No.
And of course, I took writing. I took radio and TV script writing. I even took a television production course. Of course, I didn't manipulate the cameras, but I did operate the soundboard. And we had what was called a rat race, in which they ran a whole day's radio schedule, and you were assigned to do certain things, and I was assigned to do those. So I would go up at night, and I learned how to operate the radio, board there. And by the time I was ready to do my part, I knew how to do that. So you have to have, and anybody knows this, you have to have some initiative.
Yeah.
The next guy that came around, he sort of expected people to figure out for him what to do, and do it for him. He was just there for the publicity, I'm sorry to say.
And you could read Braille well enough that
Oh, yeah.
You could read a script if someone dictated it to you.
Oh, absolutely.
You could write it with your, were you writing with a Braille writer then?
I started learning Braille with a slate and stylus, and I still use it like a pencil, but mm-hmm. for big stuff, I use my Perkins. And, you know, I just write all the time with a Perkins, and I did then too, and I could read Braille, and so I could read a script.
Very nicely. Could read,
yeah.
You could read the commercial for Sears as good
exactly.
as anybody.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. My brother, Wallace Eugene, who is long since dead, got me interested in radio. And he could read Braille fast enough. He did a little radio show on a local station there in
right.
San Antonio. And he could read those. Miss Ruth Schenkel was the secretary's name. She would come home every Friday from college. She had the scripts on tape. He had old Webcor tape recorder.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I had one of those, too.
He'd run them off on his Braille writer. You'd hear him back there typing, rocking and typing on his Braille writer. And Saturday, he'd go to the radio station and read, because they were a big copy book. There was no carts then. You read everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was either read or...
Oh, yeah.
Or,
that's when it was fun.
It was either read or it was on transcription.
Yeah.
They did have those.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, the small stations, they were very, very poor transcriptions, but the big ones. And so they taught you to run a control board, mm-hmm. taught you to cue records. I guess you probably knew that, how to
you
do that.
You had to cue up your tapes. When you were doing spots, you had to cue up the tapes. You didn't
yep.
just plop a cartridge in and hit a switch.
You had to actually put the tape on the machine, cue the reel.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, you cued records also. And they had,
absolutely, and commercial transcriptions.
And they had probably four turntables in the
oh, yeah. Four
yeah.
turntables and three tape recorders.
And it was work then.
Oh, it was work. But you know what?
What?
Your shift went by like zap, just like that. When the cart came along, and that was about 1958 when I had been in radio for 4 years, and everybody began to tape everything. And all you did was, if you had a shift, you'd sit there and play a record, and you'd say, well, the weather forecast is, and you'd hit the cart, and you'd give the time, and you'd hit a cart, and you didn't really feel like you were taking part in the program. And that's when I began to decline as far as my interest in broadcasting.
So, but you were in radio, or around radio, before McClendon came along, or the guys that came along and started doing programming like the top 40 stations,
oh,
we called
yeah.
them.
I did block programming. A typical shift, I had a typical shift for me. I would begin at 9 o'clock and work until 2. And I had a thing called Ladies' Choice in the morning. They did those record shows, and
uh-huh.
you have little features, you know. And at 11 o'clock came the Country Hour, 11 to 1, farm programs, country music. I even imitated an old character called Grandpa, and at 1 o'clock, we had an hour of classical music, believe it or not, and at 2 o'clock I went off.
And so you were doing this Ladies' Choice from 9 to 11 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
So you were playing records. Were you on 45s then, or do we still?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
45. So you would queue up these records. Did they write in requests or?
Well, they'd write them in, call them in, or whatever they wanted to do, and I'd try to find them. Sure.
And you would play these requests, and you were in your very staid announcerly voice.
Oh yeah.
And so you would do this from 9 to 11. Mm-hmm. Then at 11, did we have a network to go to at that time?
Oh well, we had a network because you always hit the news. And, of course, the networks, they usually gave you 10 seconds, and I got so time-conscious, I got to the point, Phil, that I could even ad-lib a commercial and get it to come out at 58 seconds.
Uh-huh.
I can't do that anymore, but I surely could then.
Now, how are you telling time? Did you have the Braille clock with a second hand on it?
Oh, I didn't have any clock at all. I had my watch, and I listened to the network. And sometimes the network would have a show on, and they would tell the time, and I would tell the time once in a while. But I didn't tell the time a lot. By the time I was on the air, time was not all that important. It was in the early morning when people were getting off to work. But mm-hmm. by the time Ladies' Choice came on, the time was not a critical factor. I got a secondhand clock many years later, but not when I started. Didn't have one.
Yeah, but you had just an old plain old Braille watch.
Oh yeah.
So you knew within a minute.
Oh
or so,
yeah. You you can estimate pretty closely the time.
And then the network, were they sending you a cue tone at like 20 seconds before?
Yeah, so they'd say 20 seconds, and they would say 10 seconds, and then you could come on at 10, and you could give a station break, the temperature, and the weather forecast, and hit it. And sometimes I would hit it just a split second after I would say, it's 5 o'clock. The news is coming up on ABC. And you could just get it so close because you did it all the time.
And that was a point of pride.
Oh, it was.
To
it
hit
really
that
was.
Network on time. You know, you remember Bob and Ray.
I do indeed.
The great Bob and Ray.
Oh, the great. You're right.
And, of course, they had Wally Blue. This is Wally Blue broadcasting.
Except he always came on late.
It was always Lee Blue broadcast like they'd opened the mic late.
Yeah, they did.
How many people got that? Radio guys did.
All those jokes were inside jokes.
Radio guys got that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were Lee Blue from the, you know, and the guy was hitting the mic late.
That's right.
So it was a point of pride to hit that network on time, and you got mad furious.
That's exactly
you
it.
You didn't. But you had to have some sound going so that you could hear the 10-second cue on ABC mm-hmm. on the cue circuit.
Mm-hmm.
It was work.
It was work. But it was fun work. You see, I like work. People kid me about liking work. I really mm-hmm. do like hard work. And when I had to work hard, when you had a tripled spot on the radio station, some of the little ones I worked at, you had two tape recorders and I had the triple spot. You'd put a spot on one tape recorder and one on the second, and you would play the first one but you had to run the first one back and cue up the third. And if the daggone thing was slow and rewinding, you were really sweating it out whether you were going to make it or not.
And this was actually, you weren't pushing a cart. You were physically threading a tape on a machine.
Absolutely.
And sometimes those old machines were old Viking decks mm-hmm. that didn't rewind worth a darn. And mm-hmm. so you're threading tape. So you started the first one.
Yep.
You had three queued up. You'd done that while you were playing a record.
Oh, yeah.
But you had four or five to run. So when the first one ended, you had to roll it back.
Yeah.
And that was work.
That was work. I don't know if you have time for a story.
I do.
But one day when I was doing this, the engineer said, now that top tape recorder there is a little slow, and if it stalls, you got to hit it right here.
Yeah.
That was his expertise.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It worked. And the sixth time I hit it, unfortunately, my sleeve caught the microphone switch.
Uh-huh.
And I heard my voice thundering through my headphones saying, damn it, damn it, damn it, damn it. You know the way you do.
Yeah.
And you know what? Nobody heard it.
Yeah.
I don't believe a single soul was paying attention to me at that moment because I got that feeling in your face that, you know, catastrophe has occurred. You're going to lose your job and lose your career.
Yeah.
Nobody ever mentioned it to me.
Nobody ever brought that up.
I was so glad I didn't have any listeners that afternoon.
Well, television had started, and that radio was steadily declining in terms of... But you actually worked in, and this was a little station, this was after radio school, and you got a job in radio.
Oh, yeah. I worked at three different stations altogether. The first station I worked at was run by a manager who had worked at WMFD, where I had a piano show. And mm-hmm. he got a job as a manager at this little station in Clinton, North Carolina, a little country town. And he wanted me to come there, and I didn't really want to go there for the money. But I felt it was easier to negotiate a second job if you were already working.
You're right.
So I went there and stayed there for a year. Then I went over to a town called Lumberton in Robeson County, which was famous at the time as being the only county in the country that had four school systems, one for the whites, one for the blacks, one for the Indians, and one for the Smiley family, which was accepted by none of the rest.
And these were little 1,000-watt daytimers?
Yeah, they were little 1,000-watt daytimers. And the last job I had was as an operation manager of a station in Whiteville, North Carolina. They were moving up to 10 kW, 5 kW, and they wanted me to totally refurbish the programming. And so that's where I went. And I left because I saw the satellites are coming, and I just got tired of it, and I wanted to do something else.
Well, and you realized also that you could be doing this the rest of your life.
And I was making mostly lateral moves. Typically what would happen is I would get a call from a big station saying, hey, we were passing through. We heard you on the air. We really like your work. What would you think of coming to Charlotte? And, of course, the question comes up, do you tell them you're blind? Well, I'm not ashamed of my being blind. And so I said, well, I'm glad you liked it. You thought it went well? They said, yeah, you really are tight. And I said, I'd really like to consider going up to Charlotte because I'd really like to work there. But you need to know that I'm a blind guy. And they'd say, that's fantastic. You're a blind guy. I say, yeah? Well, we'll get back to you. Sure, they'll get back to me. They disappeared into the black hole of communication and never were heard from again.
I told this story last week. I guess all you people who heard this story last week, tune out. I was working at Texas City, KTLW in Texas City, which covers Houston market. Not well, but you could hear us in Houston. K-Box in Dallas had gone country. They needed a 7 to midnight guy. I sent the guy a tape. The day he got the tape, he called me and said, Phil, can you be here Monday? And I said, yeah, I can be there Monday, but there's something you probably ought to know about me. Call the guy I'm working for now and talk to him. Of course, he never called me back.
No.
But it wasn't because I wasn't good enough to do the job. I was doing the job.
You were doing the job, as I was doing the job. But they weren't willing to take a chance. But, you know, here's something to consider. That was bad, of course. But the last guy that hired me, he said, you know, I'm taking quite a risk on you. I said, well, yeah, you are. I said, you know what I can do? He said, it's not what you can do. He said, if you work out, the board of directors are going to tell me how smart I am. If you don't work out, they're going to say, what the hell did you hire a blind guy to do this job in the first place? And it was really perceptive.
I had never
thought of the fact that the people who hired me in some cases were going out on a limb to do it.
I never thought of that. That's a great angle.
It is.
I never thought of that. I thought of it a lot of ways. I felt sorry for myself and cried about it. But that's good because he's right, too. They would have.
And he's right.
Eventually ending up in management, I understand that. And so you decided that radio maybe was not going to be your ticket to your first million.
Right.
That wasn't going to work.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know who it would be a ticket to the first million for, but it certainly wasn't for me.
You know, I think one of the things, assumptions that I've always thought, I assume that if you were one of the best at your game, in other words, if you knew engineering, programming, sales, everything about a radio station, somebody eventually would say, well, golly, isn't little Phil good? Why don't I hire him? Wrong.
I used to think the same thing.
Wrong.
And luckily, I do it in time to have a second career.
Well, I didn't. But everything has worked out fine. I'm not complaining a bit. My life is the best now it's ever been.
Right.
Radio, who needs it? And I tell you what, let's take another short break, and then we'll move you out of the radio business into something, hopefully, that made you a little money. All right?
Okay.
Be back with Ed Potter in just a sec.
Information you'll probably never need. Titillating tidbits to make you think on the blind side. Here's Don Patterson.
Louis Braille was not the inventor of Braille, as is commonly thought. He was, however, responsible for the single most important modification to dot-based reading codes. Before Braille, blind people were taught to read raised Roman letters, but this method was cumbersome and difficult to write. So in the early 1800s, several men throughout Europe began to experiment with other codes. The period 1825 to 1835 appears to have been the most active in matters relating to writing systems. In the UK, Gall, Alston, Moon, Fry, Frere, and Lucas all had their own peculiar types. Later, a similar situation would exist in America. The one code that seemed the most promising was the one invented by M. Charles Barbier, a wealthy and philanthropic military officer. He had always been interested in the education of the blind. In 1825, he suggested embossing by means of a point or stylus. The characters contained 12 dots, 6 high and 2 wide, arranged in a vertical rectangle. While Barbier's code was capable of unlimited combinations, it would prove to be impractical. The problem with the code was that the human fingertip could not feel all the dots with one touch. Braille created an improved version based on a cell of 6 dots, the well-known 3x2. This crucial improvement meant that a fingertip could detect the entire cell with one impression and move rapidly from one cell to the next. On this basis, Braille was the first to devise a practical system of reading and writing suitable to the tactile capacity of all. This was in 1829. After some slight modification, it reached its present form in 1834 and has borne his name ever since. Although the War of the Dots would rage for another 100 years, Braille's system of writing gradually came to be accepted throughout the world as the best. Over time, there has been some modifications of the Braille system, particularly the addition of contractions representing groups of letters or whole words that appear frequently in a language. Other than that, Braille's code remains basically as he intended. Louis Braille died in 1852. On the Blind Side, I'm Don Patterson.
On the Blind Side, answering questions nobody asks.
We are visiting with Ed Potter on our show called Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr, and Ed has completed high school, blind school at the Moorhead School in Carolina, North Carolina, and finished radio school and has decided radio's not what I need to do. So what happened? You one day you decided, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to do something else. Tell us about that day.
Well, I think what decided it for me is because I wasn't really taking a personal part in it anymore. It was getting to be too automatic and mechanical. Now, we weren't automated yet. But still, and of course, the board of directors or the owners of the stations were people who owned other businesses, and they didn't want to dump any more money into radio.
Yeah.
So I talked to my wife, Sue. Incidentally, I met her. She was a health educator when I was in Lumberton, and we got married. And so I said, I'm thinking of leaving radio. What would you think of taking our kids and going back to school? She said, I think that's great. I can teach chemistry, and you can go to graduate school. So that's what we did. She taught chemistry during the years I was in graduate school. I went back and got a master's degree in speech communication, and it's the greatest decision I ever made.
Well, to get out of radio was certainly a great decision.
Yeah, I think it was.
Well, I know it was. I didn't do that, but that's another story. So she, you had met this lady, and are you still married to her?
Oh, yeah.
You've been married how long?
Let's see. When is this? About 40 years.
Many years.
Yeah.
So she was already had a degree.
Yeah.
And so she could teach while you went to graduate school.
Exactly.
And a degree in speech communication. Now, what will that allow a fellow to do?
Well, it could allow him, if he didn't want to teach, you could go into public relations and all that sort of stuff. But I wanted to teach at a community college. I had helped very much the new one that had opened in Whiteville, where I had my last job. I had a lot of input in its opening and the way it developed. And I really wanted to go back there. And interestingly enough, and we'll get back to the linearity of the story, but as I was finishing graduate school, I wrote to a person I knew very well there who was a dean, and I said, I'm about to finish graduate school, and I'd sort of like to come back to work at Southeastern. And what do you think? And he wrote me a very nice two-paragraph letter. He said, Dear Ed, I think it's really great that you finally got your master's degree. That's what you wanted for a long time. Second paragraph. I must be honest with you. I have serious reservations about how a blind person can work out in the classroom.
Oh.
That was it. Now, here was a guy that knew me.
That's so frustrating.
Yeah. Now, how did I get a job? One of my young proteges in radio was a lawyer. He was working down the state looking for something to do at the community college. He ran into this guy in Goldsboro named Clyde Irwin. And Clyde said what he wanted, and Woody said, I'm not the guy, but I know who is. His name is Ed Potter, and he's finishing up graduate school. Clyde said, why don't you send him to me to talk? So Sue and I got the kids, and we got in the car and went down here to Goldsboro. I talked with Clyde for 2 hours. He showed me his seashell collection. He talked about his trip to Moscow, and then after 2 hours, he said, well, it's really been great talking with you. And I knew that I had not gotten the job.
Yeah, you knew that, even though he was very nice and very friendly to you.
But here's what happened.
All right.
He said, when can you come? Can you make it the 1st of August? I said, you mean I got the job? He said, oh, I thought you knew that. I said, but you haven't even brought up blindness at all. He said, well, that's not my problem. You're going to teach. I'm a person that will hire you to teach.
Oh, that makes me smile so big.
Doesn't it?
And he had sense enough.
All the time I've been here at Wayne Community College.
They had sense enough to understand that if you have a problem, you're blind. You're the guy that ought to solve it, not him. It's not his problem.
He never mentioned it.
Yeah. He said, all right, I thought you knew you had the job.
Yeah.
Wonderful. That makes me just feel great.
That's me too.
Because you meet so few people like that.
Exactly.
who can realize that besides being, you know, the only thing we don't have in common with sighted people is that we can't see and they can.
That's exactly.
Other than that, there's no difference. You
no
know,
no difference at all.
You got friends. I got friends. We all got friends that have the only people that they hang around with are blind people. And I asked this boy, all your friends are blind? He said, well, I don't really have anything in common with sighted people. Well, wrong. You have everything in common with them. You know.
But you have a situation there in which people get socially stigmatized and socially lazy. You know, that's just for people that say are only friends to those people that live in their own community. Or in some cases, it's blind people who really don't work to make sighted friends.
Who live in the blind community. All right, so this guy hired you. Now, this was what year? Where are
1973.
So you stayed in radio for a good while, didn't you?
I stayed in radio until 1970.
Till 70.
Yeah, I was there for 14 years.
My heavens! You worked at three stations.
Yeah.
So you were a good employee. I mean, you came and stayed if you could.
I came and stayed. I liked to get integrated myself into the community.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had a little regional advertising agency. It wasn't so much an agency. I produced commercials for banks that played on 28 or 30 stations and something like that. And I got to know people, and so I liked to stay until it was obvious that I had a good chance to move.
Yeah, or until, like me, you work for everybody in town. Nobody will hire you because you work for everybody in town already.
Right.
So in 1970, so you lasted a long. You went through all the rock and roll. You went through the screaming radio people when everybody talked
I
real
did.
Loud.
I did.
And you went through the Gordon McClendon era.
I did indeed.
So you understand all that.
I do.
Well, all right. So, but you saw satellites coming, and you were right.
Absolutely.
That's pretty much what they do now. So, okay, so 73, you took a job at this college, and you've been there ever since?
Ever since, and have loved it. I've had total and absolute freedom, and they did not mind my being a radical, and it's not something I set out to be. It's just that I'm who I am.
Well, what are you radical about? Tell me about that.
I mean, if we had a speaker who was wasting my time at a workshop, I would ask questions that everybody else wanted to ask, and nobody would.
Oh.
And I remember the vice president, who was a good friend of mine, when I was asking a lady one time a question, I've forgotten what it was, he whispered in my ear, you can stay till the end of the month, Potter.
So you ask those questions, you would say you're the sort of fellow that doesn't suffer fools well.
No, I don't. I really, really, really do not.
Yeah.
Life is too short, and the day is too short, and there are too many things to do in it.
That's true. Do you lack patience in other areas?
I'm really not so much impatient. But I am impatient when people want me to pretend that something is going on that matters when it isn't. Yeah.
Ignorance is just you just can't handle, you cannot abide it.
I have a problem with it.
Huh. All right, so you do you still teach at this college?
No, I retired in 97.
So you did 25 years or so with these people.
I got to my retirement age when I could collect my retirement and Social Security, and I quit. And then Sue and I, we run a little catalog, which I started back in 1984.
All right, let's get into that.
Well, let's get back a little bit further and talk about Playback Magazine.
All right, let's do that.
Playback Magazine started in 1979 out of pure selfishness on my part. I wanted to know all these new 800 numbers where you could buy things at discount.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured if I started a magazine that focused on that, then people would naturally call me when they knew one. So I sent out a sort of a, you might say, an introductory tape to about 50 people I knew and laid it out and said, would you be interested in subscribing to such a magazine? And I don't know whether all of them wrote back or taped back, but most did and said they would. And I thought it would last about a year, and once we ran out of toll-free numbers, it would fizzle. But it began to evolve and develop and evolve and develop, and we got people who participated and reviewed equipment and showed it off, and so we've done 144 issues. I just did my July issue, which I call my gross issue. It's 144.
Now, you started this at a time when you had a job. This was a hobby at that time.
It was a hobby. And it was a way for me to still be a radio person. You don't ever really quite get that out of your system.
Well, why do you think I'm here?
I know.
I'm here because no one will hire me to do mornings.
Right.
You know. No, that's not true in my case. But anyway,
right.
that's part of it. You never get over.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
Your, as we used to say, vaccination with a phonograph needle.
That's exactly it.
Back when these kids don't even know what phonograph needles are. But that used to be the common saying, he was vaccinated with a phonograph needle. So you started this little magazine to get 800 numbers,
right.
And you're right, once you ran out of those, everything would have been over.
Yeah.
But people began sending you articles reviewing pieces of equipment they'd bought or...
Right, they bought or they'd seen. And so the magazine evolved to the point that it's carried by its subscribers. I do a couple of articles, and I narrate it and sort of tie things together. But the real bulk and the worth of the magazine is all these 700 or 800 people who get it, who think about Playback when it comes to something they've learned that's new. They either call me or they send me a tape or whatever the case, and there we are.
Now, this is a magazine on cassette.
On cassette. It comes out 6 times a year.
You do not offer a Braille edition?
No.
Well,
because it's too personal for a Braille edition.
I can't believe that, being the Braille guy you are.
Well, it's cheaper on a cassette, Phil.
Well, there's that. It is cheaper. You can buy those suckers in bulk and get them pretty cheap.
You bet.
What, your international cassette? Where do you get them?
I get them from an importer.
Yeah.
I buy usually about 10,000 at a time.
Yeah.
And, of course, I have 6 high-speed telex duplicators over here.
That will do how many at a time?
I can run off 14 copies at a time every 3 minutes.
14 copies every 3 minutes?
Yeah.
And what is the quality of those? I mean,
quality is remarkably good. It's not what you would call hi-fi music, but the speech quality is good. All the sibilants and the S's and the high ends are there because
yeah.
I intend for them to be.
Well, they got to be here. I'll have to put them through an equalizer and turn it up
because
I've got to hear them.
Yeah, I have too.
I don't know how I got to be like that,
yeah.
But doing AM.
I'm fussy about the quality of Playback. Today.
Doing AM radio, you couldn't hear them, but
no,
you know,
true.
Except that toward the end of AM, we got an equalizer and put it on. Bought a Radio Shack equalizer and put it after before the processor, and we heard.
Oh
them.
Yeah.
Anyway, this magazine comes out 6 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
And you narrate it. It's on a 120-minute cassette.
90-minute tape.
On a 90-minute tape. Now, are you looking for subscribers?
Well, we always like to have new subscribers. They got to pay for it. But it's $21 a year.
$21 a year. So, and it's mailed to your home 6
right.
times a year. Free matter is blind for blind people.
Correct.
Okay. Give us a couple of addresses or something somewhere somebody could...
Well, I'll give you 2 telephone numbers and an address.
Good deal.
If you just want to talk a while, which is great, please don't use my toll-free number because I pay for it. One lady said when I tried to rush her on, she said, well, it's free. I said, you don't pay for it, but I do.
Well, you know, we're on your dime. I thought about that for a
No, no. You see, I have flat fee long distance. Don't worry about that.
Okay.
So the idea is you can call me at 919-736-0939.
Give it, do that a little slower if you don't mind.
919-736-0939.
All right.
If you want to place an order with us, you can call toll-free at 888-217-2312. That's 888-217-2312.
Okay. That's for orders only.
Right.
Now, this magazine is mostly, most of the articles are from subscribers.
Yeah, they are, except I do an article called Products, Resources, and Trends, in which I just sort of peruse everything I can come up with and come out with about a 20-minute article of resources and products that are just out and little scuttlebutts. We have a what we call a focus mini report. People call in little 2 or 3 minute reports, and I string them together, and we'll have about, 8, 10, 12 on each magazine. Then we have a free classified service for members, and so, you know, it's a kind of like a family. It's a good bunch of guys who get playback. I just love them to death, and apparently they put up with me, too.
Now, the classified, what would you find there? Items for sale to buy?
Items for sale, if you're looking for something, it's basically that. Whatever you want information about, whatever you want to sell, or whatever you're looking for to buy, we put it in classified for you. Free.
Like, I had a lightning hit 3 weeks ago, and I lost my AM stereo tuner.
Mm.
And, of course, you know they don't make them anymore.
They don't, right.
And, of course, most people have turned their stereo pilot off, but
right.
There are still some. If I wanted to buy one, I could put that in your classifieds.
You could, right.
Well, I'll be darned. Now, and I think I asked you this the other day, but let's do it on the air. I have an MDR 2496 Mackie 24-track recorder. Would it a good thing for me to do a review on that and send it to you?
Well, here's what goes on with things.
Okay.
People who get playback like to know what's out there and how it works.
Uh-huh.
It isn't just a matter of having things on the magazine that people might buy. We like to know all the stuff technologically. So, you know, if you own one of these things and you used it and it works for you, people would like to know what it is, how it works, and we just all love gadget people. We just like to know what's out there.
So you'd like to know how I figured out how to move files and do some of the things sighted people can do without sight.
Yeah, that might be interesting, right.
See, okay. All right, so that's the kind of thing you want.
I
cannot believe that I've not heard of this magazine. As many radio nuts as blind people that I know, and as big a radio nut as I am, and as gadget as I am, I've never heard of this magazine.
Well, you have now.
I have now, haven't I? Now, are you computer literate? Have you started fooling with them or not?
Well, let me tell you about computers. I have learned about computers. I can talk the language. I know all the words and how they function. But I have people that can go to websites for me in a hurry.
Yeah.
So I just don't want to spend 4 hours a day for 6 months learning the ins and outs of how to use it. If I did not have people who were here to go on the net when I needed to go on the net, I'd sit down 4 hours a day and go through the gruel of doing it myself. But you see, as I said earlier, and I don't really mean this as an excuse for not having done it, life is short and days are short.
Yes,
there's
they are.
Things I want to do. And if I can get the stuff I need to have done on a computer done quicker by having somebody do it, then why should I do it myself?
Well, especially when you get our age, the days do dwindle down to a precious few.
They do.
They do. So, but you know what a hard drive is.
Oh, absolutely.
You know
sure.
what? You know what?
I know the language. I know the concepts. And you and I could talk computers for 20 minutes, and you'd really never know that I don't use one.
And you know what speech synthesizer is.
Absolutely.
You know what RAM is. You know what this.
Yeah.
You know all those things.
RAM, ROM, and all the rest.
So you can talk the language. You'd almost have to these days to deal with the kind of things you deal with your.
Well, you see, we do a lot of computer talk and playback.
Have to, yes.
And
yeah,
I could learn it, but I'm just not going to as long as somebody's willing to go on the net for me.
Well, I do kind of the same thing. If there's anything other than checking my email or typing in my journal, my wife does it for me.
Right.
And it's not been. I'm like you. I understand a lot about computers. Not a lot, but I understand basically how they work and what's what. But I don't know much about them. I mean, I can't do much on one.
Well, some of my blind friends say, well, don't you want to be independent? I said, look, I've done enough in my life that if people don't believe I'm independent, but now, learning to use a computer is not going to convince them of it.
I just hooked up a 32-in 8-out console in every orifice, and it has something in that jack. I don't need to prove my independence to anybody.
No, you don't need to.
I know what I'm doing. But I do run across blind people occasionally, like Kevin Doucet, this friend of mine that I've met in Alabama. It's just a whiz. I mean,
it's just second nature.
Yeah, it is to him. He is at my house 2 days, and he finally said, "Phil, I'm having withdrawals. Can I go play on your computer?" Well, hell yeah, go on, go right ahead. All right. So you don't have an email address for this magazine? Is what I'm trying to get around to.
I have a telephone. Now, let me tell you about email. I don't like email as such, and here's why. You have to look at it and read it, and so much crap comes down the pike that you don't want to read.
Yeah.
If somebody wants to say something to me, how much does it cost a minute to make a call? I'm glad to talk with you, but if I gave my email address out, and we have one, if I gave my email address out on playback, I can't imagine the hundreds of emails that would come in about everything in the world that I don't want to know.
Well, you're probably right, and it's, you know, you do have telephones. And,
I do have telephone. I invite people to call and use it.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we're down to about 90 seconds.
Okay.
Let's give our phone numbers one more time and generate some interest, and I'll go ahead and subscribe after we get off the air, all right?
All right.
Go ahead.
Phone number is 919-736-0939. Or 888-217-2312, or you can write in any format at 1308 Evergreen, Evergreen Avenue, Goldsboro, Goldsboro, North Carolina, 27530.
Ed Potter, it has been a privilege and very enjoyable visiting.
Thank you, Bill. I enjoyed it, too.
We're going to sign off. I don't know when this will run, but I'll call you before it does, all right?
Great.
Ed Potter, publisher of Playback Magazine. We hope you'll call him and subscribe. We've enjoyed it, and we'll talk with you a little later, Ed.
Right.
Thank you, Ed Potter. What a heck of an interview. I did subscribe to the magazine. By the way, if you'd like to be a guest on Blind Like Me, email me at blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. Blindlikeme at txucom.net, and we'll have you as a guest on the Blind Like Me show. We're not looking for people who are skydivers or people who have done amazing things, although we've had some of those on the show. We're looking for blind people who have dealt successfully with being blind. Remember, it's an inconvenience and not a handicap. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week with more Blind Like Me. Stay tuned, by the way, for the Blind Andy Man. Those guys with hammers and saws.